Anatomy and Physiology, the Digestive System, Part 2. We left off last time by taking a look at the esophagus, so now we're going to see where that dumps into, which of course is the stomach. Just a little overview slide here. There are four major regions of the stomach. We'll look at them one at a time in this order. First, we'll take a look at the cardia, followed by the fundus. Then we'll look at the big body of the stomach. And finally, the cone-shaped end of the stomach called the pylorus. The cardia, I love the name. Cardia, root word, means heart. And sure enough, the cardia is the part of the stomach that surrounds the top part of the stomach, and it is near the heart. Once again, I want to stress half the battle in anatomy and half the battle in healthcare when someone comes to see with pain is kind of knowing what is there. What are the possibilities that might be causing the pain? So sure, you could have some disease affecting this part of the stomach and it may mimic heart pain. So this will be in your differential diagnosis, so to speak. Then up and to the left of the cardia is this rounded, bulbous part of the stomach called the fundus. I like to say the fundus is kind of where the fun begins. But one important point I do want you to know for my course is when someone has an x-ray of their belly, you'll often see this done in the emergency room. Someone's involved in trauma and they do a stat x-ray. It happens all the times on those medical TV shows. Why are they shooting those stat x-rays? One reason is to look for the fundus of the stomach, because if it's normal, you should see a nice dark black air bubble on the x-ray. So air is what normally you will see in the fundus of the stomach in a patient who is standing erect. So that's a good thing to look for. If it's not there, you're worried maybe there's a rupture of this organ, for example. This reminds me of a television show that is called Scrubs, not exactly medically accurate, a TV show. But I notice every time they do the intro, they have someone putting an x-ray, a chest x-ray, up in the view box. And it always kind of bothered me a little bit. Does anybody know if that x-ray is put in there the right way or not? If you take a good look at it, and I'm not advocating or pushing that TV show in any way at all. Don't take me wrong. This is just for fun. But they put it in backwards. The way you can know is twofold. Number one, the heart is on the wrong side. You'll see the heart shadow on the right side of the body. Number two, you'll see that black air bubble in the fundus of the stomach also on the right side of the body where it doesn't belong. So they put that chest x-ray up in there backwards, don't they? Next part of the stomach is the big part. It's called the body. It's the large central part of the stomach, and this brings me to Anatomy 101. The body of almost every organ in anatomy is the big part of that organ. Then we have the cone-shaped end piece of the stomach called the pylorus. This part of the stomach connects with the first part of the small intestine that you should know is called the duodenum. I always get asked in class, how big is the stomach? Well, your book says when it's empty, it's about the size of a large sausage. I guess that's about right. But you know that the stomach can stretch out, kind of like an accordion. And it can stretch out due to the presence of these specialized temporary folds of the mucosa and submucosa that are called rugae, R-U-G-A-E. That's fun to say. And then people often ask me, well, how big can the stomach get? And I Googled it one day, and the biggest number I found on the internet was 25 liters. Let me put that in English. That's 5 gallons. Could you imagine a 5-gallon, like, bucket of paint inside somebody? Now, I don't believe everything I read on the internet, but let's just say the stomach can get a lot bigger than a large sausage because it stretches out due to the rugae. Maybe that's why those people who win those hot dog eating contests can shove in like 81 hot dogs in 5 minutes or whatever they do. Here's a beautiful picture up top, just a drawing, but down below is a real human stomach kind of filleted open, and it emphasizes some basic anatomy. Number one, people typically describe the stomach as a J-shaped sac because it is shaped like a J, or I guess like a candy cane if you want. And a little bit of anatomy here. Notice that the big outer curve of the J is called the greater curvature. Recall that the greater omentum hung down from the greater curvature. You should see that in the cat lab. And then the little inner curve of the J, the little inner nook of the candy cane, if you will, that's called the lesser curvature because it's littler. And that is where the lesser omentum hung up from the stomach to the liver. Also on this slide, you can see the gorgeous rouge in the stomach as well. Now is where the physiology hits the fan. We got a lot of physiology coming up in this section and in our sections that follow. This slide is absolutely key. You cannot understand how the stomach works unless you understand the gastric mucosa. Here is a drawing of the gastric mucosa, including the three layers of the gastric mucosa that you've already learned. But the key here is the epithelial layers, because the epithelium is where all the action is. We will learn that there are five separate cell types with five separate names and five separate functions, and you're going to have to take notes on this slide. The general big picture setup is this. If we follow the gastric mucosa along, every once in a while it dips down, and those little slits are called gastric pits. The gastric pits are lined by these special columnar epithelial cells that make juices, and collected together, those columnar epithelial cells that line the gastric pits are called gastric glands. And the juice that the gastric glands make are called gastric juice. So it ain't rocket science. We got gastric pits lined by gastric glands that squirt into these pits a juice called gastric juice. Let's break it down. At the top, we have a cell called a surface mucus cell. Take a wild guess what surface mucus cells make. Yeah, they make mucus. What is mucus for in a human body? You should automatically have this roll off the tip of your tongue. Mucus cells make mucus to lubricate and protect. Then, a little bit deeper down here in the gland, we have a mucus neck cell. And again, that makes mucus, of course, to lubricate and to protect. So the first two are easy. Mucus cells make mucus. Then we have one of our key cells in the stomach called the parietal cell. And when I'm writing this down on the board, I spell this word with a capital A and a capital I. That AI doesn't stand for artificial intelligence. It stands for acid and intrinsic factor, because the two key ingredients of your stomach juice made by the parietal cell are strong hydrochloric acid and intrinsic factor. I want you to know now what intrinsic factor is for in the stomach. Intrinsic factor is what allows you to absorb vitamin B12. If you don't have intrinsic factor or enough of it, you can't absorb B12 out of your dietary intake. Furthermore, what I want you to write down on this slide, because it shows up in the real world, not just on tests, if someone is deficient in intrinsic factor and they are therefore deficient in B12, they will develop a very common disease. It's a disease where they have low blood count, specifically low red blood cells. You will tell me on the test that that is called anemia. More specifically, it's called pernicious anemia. That's a little bit too detailed for this course. But if you just know if someone has anemia, if they're deficient in B12, that's good enough for me. So what? The reason I mention this is you will see people with stomach diseases. Maybe they'll have bad infections. Maybe they'll have severe ulcers or cancers. or loss of stomach tissue due to other things like trauma or surgery. And you'll notice on their lab slips, they'll have an anemia. And you'll first think to yourself, well, why does this person have anemia? They just have a stomach problem. Well, now you know why. It's because if you damage enough parietal cells, they won't make intrinsic factor, they can't absorb B12, and they'll develop anemia. And how will you treat those patients? You all will do it if you go into healthcare. You'll have to inject them on a periodic basis with vitamin B12 through an intramuscular injection because they can't absorb it through the food chute. The next cell I want you to know is the chief cell shown here, and I want you to spell it wrong to try to remember it. Spell it C-H-E-E-F. And I capitalize those two E's when I'm spelling it on the board. I remember double E's for double enzymes. This cell makes two digestive enzymes. They are pepsinogen and gastric lipase. We have to know what each of those enzymes helps digest. And I'm going to make it easy on you. For my course, we're going to assume there are only three major food groups that we eat. Carbs, lipids, and proteins. So take a wild guess from your previous A&P knowledge what pepsinogen digests. Think back. You studied amino acids. You put them together with peptide bonds. You made peptides. You grew them together in strings, and you called them proteins. So you guessed it. Pepsinogen with a P helps digest proteins with a P. Then gastric lipase, this is a no-brainer. Root word lipase refers to lipids. ACE in anatomy, that root word means enzyme. So gastric lipase is an enzyme that digests lipids. Finally, the fifth cell is the G cell. The G cell makes a hormone called gastrin. I love the G cell. G for G cell, G for gastrin. And gastrin is a hormone that has the root word for stomach in it. So it kind of hooks together real nice. This is one of our enteroendocrine cells, a gut hormone cells. We'll learn as we progress in this unit and other units that hormones control everything in the human body. So what does gastrin do from the G cell? It gets all the other cells above it to start secreting their juices. And gastrin also goes to the muscularis layer and gets the muscles of the stomach churning. So how do I remember it? I just think to myself, gastrin gets it all going. Gets all the juices going and gets all the muscles going. Based on that knowledge, I should be able to ask you a really critical thinking question. Let's say you're the CEO of a major drug company and you want to become a multi-bazillionaire. You want to make a new drug that decreases acid in somebody's stomach, maybe to help them with ulcers or reflux or something like that. Which cell or cells could you potentially target with your new drug to decrease acid production in the stomach? Well, everyone picks off immediately the parietal cell because sure enough, the parietal cell directly makes the acid, and pretty much all the drugs you know of in the market today are targeting the parietal cell. If you think a little bit further, there's one more cell you could target. You could potentially target the G cell because remember, the G cell gets it all going, including all the cells above it. So if you target the G cell, you'll knock back the parietal cell, so indirectly you will decrease acid production. Now that's just a theoretical question, because in real life, no one's going to really probably target the G cell, because otherwise you'd knock off all these other important cells above, and we really don't want to do that. But if you do think of a new drug, remember, cut me in 1%. Another thing on this slide, notice there's two mucus cells. That might tell you something about the stomach. The stomach has a thick protective mucus layer. Some books I think say up to a quarter of an inch. In any case, it's a really thick protective layer. We talked about the critical importance of the gastric mucosa. Now we'll look at the other layers. Remember, one of your jobs is, as we look at each organ in the food chute, look at the four layers, look for anything special that fits its special function. So here we have a submucosa, and really, I got nothing new to say here. It contains the same old junk, connective tissue, vessels, and I really can't think of any special question I could ask you here. If I were you on this slide, I'd write same old, same old. He can't ask me anything new or different here. Ah, but what about the next layer, the muscularis? Is there something special here? You bet. Because if you remember from previous, almost all the food chute has two layers of smooth muscle. But this has three layers of smooth muscle. Check out your picture. We have longitudinal outer, a middle circular, then they shoved in an extra inner layer of oblique muscle fibers, which just means diagonal, by the way. So three layers of smooth muscle. Why? Why three layers? Why muscle? You have muscle to move things. So the design matches the mission once again. We're going to learn very shortly that one of the main jobs of the stomach is to pulverize and churn your food into smithereens. And so an extra layer of muscle helps your stomach do its function, which is basically a pulverizing and churning chamber. The last major layer of the gut wall, you hopefully will recall, is the serosa. It's the shiny covering on our guts. But please remember, somebody gave another name to the serosa on our organs below the diaphragm. It is called the visceral peritoneum. So again, same old, nothing new on this slide. Here's the other major thing you're supposed to be doing besides looking at the layers. You're supposed to decide what is happening in this organ as far as digestion and absorption. And as far as digestion goes, you have to further break it down. What is happening as far as mechanical digestion and chemical digestion? So, in the stomach, is there any mechanical digestion? You bet. This is a big churning chamber. It also can hold your food. I think your book says food can sit there for an hour or so before it starts to churn. But once it starts churning, it really starts to do its job. It does it through a special series of muscular contractions, sort of a special form of peristalsis specific for the stomach called mixing waves. These mixing waves will churn the bolus of food you just ate with the magical digestive juices we just discussed and turn it into a soupy, acidy liquid called chyme. C-H-Y-M-E. Look at what this slide is saying. Because I don't know about you, but before I took this course, I thought like if I ate a cheeseburger, by the time the stomach was done with it, it would just kind of maybe be like a halfway, you know, churned up, mushy cheeseburger. But that's not really right. If the stomach's doing its job, it should churn your food into an acid soup by the time it's done with it. And then in class, usually someone raises their hand and they say, well, what about corn? Well, what about corn? Okay, here's the deal. The stomach can churn your food into an acid soup if you don't eat too much, don't eat too fast, if you chew your food properly. But even then, there are some certain things that we can't digest fully. There are certain parts of plants, for example, we can't completely, totally digest. So that's your answer to what about corn. Here's more details on mechanical digestion. It turns out that these mixing waves we just talked about from all these three layers of muscle become more and more vigorous as you travel from the body of the stomach to the pylorus, where most of the churning takes place. And there's very intense waves as you approach the pylorus. And each mixing wave will periodically squirt out only about one teaspoon of the chyme through this sphincter called the pyloric sphincter into the duodenum. Again, I don't know about you, but before I took this course, I thought, again, the stomach would take my cheeseburger, maybe make it into like a halfway ball of mush, and then just shove it maybe all at once into my duodenum. But no, if it's going properly, like we just talked about, it should just be squirting out 1 teaspoonful at a time of the acid soup into my duodenum. I want to stop on this slide and talk about something called pyloric stenosis. Pyloric stenosis means some babies are born with this valve too tight. And if it's too tight, their food, their nutrients can't get past it and can't make it into the small intestine. And that's bad because the small intestine is really where we absorb and digest most of our foods. So if a baby can't get food from the stomach to the small intestine, they're going to die. These babies present very early on in life with vomiting. It's not just the drool kind of mucousy white stuff that comes on the burp cloth if you have a baby. This is across the room, splatter on the wall, exorcist type vomiting. It's very scary to the family. The babies get rushed to the emergency room. They're diagnosed with a condition called pyloric stenosis. It's usually the firstborn male in the family. Very interesting. You could search that on the internet. Usually presents about within the first 3 months of life, and you schedule them for surgery the same day, rush them up to the OR, and they do what's called a pyloromyotomy, which means cut the muscle of the pyloric valve. They make some relaxing incisions, essentially, that allow this to open up, and the baby's good to go. Is there any chemical digestion in the stomach? Answer, yes. A little bit of lipid digestion because we have gastric lipase, but over here I want you to write in the margin, not much. Just a little bit of lipid digestion in the stomach. What really begins big time chemically in the stomach is protein digestion with a star. This is where we really start to chemically break apart our proteins. And look how it happens. First, we have our old friend, our nice strong hydrochloric acid. It denatures the protein. Remember that word denature? Denature means to change the shape. Or I like to write down here, hydrochloric acid unfolds the protein. You remember protein structure. There's primary, secondary, tertiary, quaternary. Well, think of your cheeseburger in your belly like a big wadded up ball of protein strands. When hydrochloric acid hits it, it unfolds it, let's say, into a straight line. Step number two, look at this. Hydrochloric acid comes back again and transforms pepsinogen, which is inactive, into pepsin, which is active. Notice the root words, pepsinogen. Break down you root words. Genesis means the beginning of, or to create, or to make. So pepsinogen is just the beginning of the active enzyme called pepsin. And hydrochloric acid has the responsibility of converting it from the inactive to the active form. Once we have active pepsin, pepsin pops the peptide bonds between the amino acids in that nice long protein that we straighten out. So on the board, I usually draw a line, and then I take my eraser. I pretend my eraser is the pepsin, and I just make little breaks in the protein strand. I pretend I'm breaking peptide bonds and busting and popping that protein into its components we call amino acids. So yeah, big time protein digestion in the stomach chemically heavily relies on hydrochloric acid. Look how important hydrochloric acid is. Think back to our non-specific defenses as well. We have acid in our belly also to protect us from any bacteria that we might ingest as well, because acid can destroy some of those organisms. This is a great slide to ask you a critical thinking question. It is fair game for the test. Think about what we just learned. Don't just memorize it. Now, why doesn't the stomach eat itself? Why doesn't it digest itself? I mean, look, you got acid, you got enzymes. I mean, why doesn't the stomach just eat a hole through its protein muscle coat and just bore a hole and pop a hole out? I mean, why don't we all just have a perforated stomach from the first month of life? The answer is twofold. Number one, you should remember, thick protective mucus layer in the stomach. The second answer is key, and it's on this slide. Pepsinogen, as it sits in the mucosa in the chief cell, is it active? Can it eat a hole backwards out through the muscle wall? The answer is no. The pepsinogen first has to get secreted from the chief cell. It makes its way across the mucus layer into the lumen of the stomach where it meets up with acid. The acid converts it into the active form, but then the active pepsin does not have the ability to get back through the mucus layer to dissolve the stomach. So that's why the stomach doesn't eat itself. You might be thinking to yourself, how does the stomach know what to do? I mean, how does it know when to secrete and when to move? So this slide is titled Regulation of Gastric Secretion and Motility, and it's all regulated by what we call the three phases of digestion. The three phases of digestion regulate other organs in the guts as well, but we're talking about the stomach now, so let's apply it to the stomach. The three phases of digestion are the cephalic phase, the gastric phase, and the intestinal phase. And we'll stop right here on the slide and make some notes, because those root words tell you something. They tell you where the food is. In the cephalic phase, the food is in your head. Root word cephalo means in your head. In the gastric phase, the food is in your stomach. And in the intestinal phase, you guessed it, the food is in our intestines. Let's start with the cephalic phase. That means the food is in your head. That means you see it, you smell it, you're thinking of it, you're tasting it. The food is in your head. What happens when the food is in your head? Well, the rest and digest division, that is really called the parasympathetic division of the autonomic nervous system, gets fired up. And what does it do? It increases salivation, gastric motility, and secretion of gastric juices with double stars. So the ANS gets the stomach moving and juicing. And don't forget what's in the juice. Our all-important hormone called gastrin. Gastrin is a hormone, like many hormones. It circulates through the blood. And when it hits the stomach, what does gastrin do? Well, gastrin gets it all going as well. Gastrin gets the stomach muscles moving, and gastrin also gets the stomach cells juicing. So if I were you, I would draw a line here from gastrin to the gastric motility and draw a line to gastric juices. So we have a double signal. We'll see this over and over again in the anatomy and physiology. Our whole bodies essentially are controlled by a combination of nerve signals and hormone signals. Okay, so what? Some of you are thinking, well, I'll memorize this slide, but I'll never see it in the real world. Yeah, you will. If you're thinking of eating right now, maybe you're getting hungry, your stomach's gurgling, right? That's the stomach moving and the stomach juicing. How about this? One year I had in class a really bright student. He raised his hand and he said, Dr. Gontra, I know how this is useful. And I thought to myself, really? How? I want to know, so I want to tell somebody else. So he says, yeah, I'm in a radiology program, and we were doing what's called an upper GI series on a five-year-old boy. That's where you have the boy swallow some barium dye. The dye is supposed to flow through the guts. It outlines the digestive tract so you can look for abnormalities, like tumors and ulcers and other things, blockages. So he swallowed the dye, and the dye got stuck in his stomach. And that's not good because, number one, if the dye doesn't flow through the stomach, you can't outline the rest of the digestive tract, and you can't complete your study. Number two, it's not good to have barium stuck in your body. So guess what the radiologist did based on the knowledge of this slide to get the barium dye to flow through the boy's body? He asked the boy, "What's your favorite food?" And the boy said, "McDonald's cheeseburgers." And at that instant, while the boy was under the x-ray, they saw the dye immediately shoot through the stomach and through the rest of the guts. All based on knowledge of this slide, they got the dye to flow out of the stomach by just making the boy think of food. So yes, this is real life stuff. The next phase is called the gastric phase. So in the gastric phase, where's the cheeseburger? Where's the fries? No, where's the double whopper with extra mayo, double meat, double cheese? Of course, we're going to supersize the fries. It happened the other day. I was in wherever I was, Burger King somewhere, and the lady in front of me ordered the double whopper with the double meat, double cheese, extra mayo, supersized the fries. And then what she ordered to wash it all down with? A Diet Coke. And I'm thinking, lady, you are all in at this point in time. What is the point of the Diet Coke? And she says, it evens it all out. And I'm thinking, it doesn't even anything out. Anyway, I'm sure you're not the only one who's seen that. I just don't get it. The point is on this slide, where's the food in the gastric phase? It's in the stomach. How does the stomach know it has the food? Oh, it goes back to our study of sensory receptors. Mechanical stretch receptors, they detect the stretching of the stomach. And chemical receptors, they detect a change in the pH of the stomach juice. You have to know which way it changes. Does it go up or does it go down? The answer is it increases. Two ways to remember that. Number one, there's only really one way for the pH of stomach juice to go, and that's up, because the pH of stomach juice is already somewhere around 1 or 2. That's really low. So there's really only one way to go but up. The real reason, though, is in our diets, of course, there's a significant amount of protein. When you think back to acid-base balance, remember, proteins were a big buffer in our body. So when we eat proteins, that buffers the acids in our stomach. So when we eat something, it increases the pH of our gastric juice. So now the stomach knows it has the food by the stretch receptors and the chemical receptors. And once you fire those receptors off, they send signals, once again, to the autonomic nervous system. Also, they send their signals to the cells that make gastrin, and those two things together both start the stomach secreting juices and they increase gastric motility. They get the stomach moving and juicing. The last phase is called the intestinal phase. Where's the food in the intestinal phase? You'll tell me, it's in the intestines. How does the intestine know it has the Whopper? Same basic idea. Stretch receptors detect stretching of the duodenum, which is the first part of the small intestine. And chemical receptors also detect it. How? Three chemicals I want you to know they detect. Well, they can taste that real acidy soup called chyme. They also can taste or detect the partially digested triglycerides. That's like the cheese. And they also can detect the partially digested proteins. That's the burger. So that's why I always say cheeseburger, because it helps me remember on this slide that chemical receptors in the intestine, not only do they taste, of course, the strong acid, they taste the cheese and they taste the burger. That's the triglycerides and the proteins. So what happens now? We just shoved a Whopper in our duodenum. Don't rush your answer. What is the autonomic nervous system going to tell the stomach to do? Because on this slide, we're talking about regulation of the stomach. Do you want to tell the stomach, yeah, show me another cheeseburger, a couple more pieces of pizza? Of course not. You want to tell the stomach to slow down. Take it easy. I just got a Whopper. Let me deal with it now. So in this case, the ANS decreases gastric secretions and motilities. Secondly, the small intestine is very smart, and it secretes a hormonal signal as well. These hormones are called, wait for it, secretin and cholecystokinin with triple stars. Now, that's a big word, and everyone who's in my group, when I'm out on the weekend drinking soda with my friends, we all call it CCK. If they say cholecystokinin, I take their soft drink, I drink it in front of them, and then I kick them out of my group. But you must know secretin and CCK. They are the all-powerful, all-controlling hormones that pretty much tell all our guts what to do. Not just our stomach, like we're talking about today, but we'll see next unit that they also tell the gallbladder, the liver, the pancreas, what to do as well. But right now, here's what you remember. Secretin tells the stomach stop secreting. CCK tells the stomach stop contracting. For some reason, my brain, which is weird, out of CCK, I make the word contract out of those letters. Because the big picture is, again, we don't want any more from the stomach. We want to tell the stomach to calm down. So secretin tells stomach stop secreting. CCK tells stomach stop contracting. Note, big picture, each phase of control has a nervous system control from the ANS and also a hormonal control. That's a common theme in the human body. The other major question you're supposed to ask yourself when you study the food chute organs is, what is happening as far as absorption? On this slide, if I were you, right up at the top, I would pencil in not much, because really not much absorption at all happens in the stomach. All this slide says a little bit of water, a little bit of ions. So in other words, like a little bit of salt water gets absorbed, and some drugs. The ones I want you to know are especially aspirin and a little bit of alcohol. I want to give you an example to stress the last bullet point on the slide you probably already know. Let's say you're the triage nurse in the ER. Two people came to you, to you intoxicated from a local bar. They both had 8 umbrella drinks. One person had 8 drinks on an empty stomach. One person ate a pepperoni pizza first and then drank the 8 umbrella drinks, same amount of drinks in the same period of time. Which person will be intoxicated sooner and intoxicated more? It's the person who had the drinks on the empty stomach. Why? You need to know that fat content in the stomach slows the stomach down, and it slows passage of alcohol to the small intestine. And as we'll learn very shortly, the small intestine is like a shop vac. It's an absorption machine. It sucks things into your body rapidly. So the longer we keep things like alcohol in our stomach, it slows down their absorption into our system and into, therefore, our brain, for example. So you might have known that already. If you eat a big fatty meal, doesn't it feel like stuff's just kind of hung up in there for a while? And fat is the hardest thing for your stomach to deal with. Carbs go through the quickest, protein second, but fats are the slowest thing to get delivered from the stomach into the small intestine. I don't have a whole lot to say about emesis. You should know that emesis means vomiting. That's a great fill-in-the-blank kind of a question. So if you're out on the floors as a nurse and someone says, bring the emesis basin, please don't bring the urinal, or please don't bring any other device. The emesis basin is the vomiting basin. What is vomiting? It's the forceful expulsion of contents from the stomach and sometimes the duodenum up and out through the mouth. Notice it says sometimes the duodenum. That is some seriously deep Mac Daddy vomiting if you're vomiting from down here in your duodenum. You might have heard of somebody throwing up bile. Well, we'll learn in the next unit that bile is injected into the duodenum. So if someone's throwing up bile, they're vomiting deep and they're vomiting from a really forceful kind of a fashion. This reminds me of a true story about my son. He's kind of a little bit different from me in this respect. I used to hate to throw up. I still hate to vomit. I do everything I can to stop it. A lot of you might be thinking the same thing. But one night in the middle of the night, 3 a.m., my wife and I were sleeping, and we heard the little pitter-patter of little feet coming down the hallway. If you have kids, you know what's coming. So we got out of our beds, met them halfway there, and we heard this big splat on the floor. And he threw up, and he's just standing there, and he's just looking at it in amazement. And he looks down, and he says, "Daddy, look, I made a star, and it was in the perfect pattern of the star." He was so fascinated with his vomit. But anyway, I just couldn't understand that because I'm totally opposite him on that sort of a deal. Now we hit the small intestine. This is really where all the action's happening. Gonna start you with some numbers, and yes, I'm not big on numbers, but I do want you to know these. In a living person, the small intestine is 10 feet long and 1 inch in diameter. The three parts of the small intestine in order that you're probably seeing on the kitty cat are the duodenum, the jejunum, and the ileum. And you should know about how long they are in order. They're 1 foot, 3 feet, and 6 feet. And yep, if I'm doing my math right, that adds up to a total of 10 feet. How do I remember the order? Duodenum, jejunum, ileum. Well, here's a true story. In college, I did a lot of DJing, and I was really good at it. And when I put up signs, because we didn't have any electronic devices back then, when I posted signs on campus that I was going to be the DJ, hundreds of people just flocked to my parties. I was good at it. I mean, I did the whole spin thing and the scratch thing, everything. So people came to my parties. So how does this hook in to a memorization technique? Because I think of myself as a DJ I want to be. DJ I want to be. DJI for duodenum, jejunum, ileum, and that's how I never forget it. Anyway, that gig didn't work out, so I'm here doing this. Yes, I had a name. I had a DJ name, and people always raised their hand in class. Tell us your DJ name, please. I'll say it here. I probably shouldn't, but anyway, it was Master G. But let's move on. The small intestine ends at the part of the large intestine called the cecum. What did some genius call the valve where the ileum meets the cecum? It's called the ileocecal valve. This piece of our body, called the small intestine, does the majority of digestion and absorption. Look what the last bullet point says. Our small intestine absorbs about 90% of all the nutrients and water that we ingest. What is special about this organ that allows it to do that? One of the keys is large surface area. Underline it or highlight it because that's a recurrent theme in physiology. If an organ has high surface area, that allows it to do a lot more work a lot more efficiently. I'll give you an example. You've seen air filters in your car or in your home. Is it just one flat sheet of paper like out of your notebook? No. It's like all pleated and folded, or if it's made of fibers, it's all intertwined fibers. And if you unwound that, it would be a big, long thing, a lot bigger than a piece of paper of a similar size. So surface area allows this organ to be a digestion and absorption machine. Think of your small intestine, please, like a shop vac sucking in almost all the liquid and nutrients. What are the features that give it surface area, huge surface area? Three things you have to know. They are, in order, circular folds, villi, and microvilli. This is the organizational slide. We'll look at each of those briefly in that order. This is a beautiful gross anatomy picture of the jejunum sliced open long ways, and you're seeing these circular folds in 3D. They kind of circle or spiral through the small intestine. They are permanent folds of mucosa and submucosa. They cannot stretch out like in the stomach. Remember in the stomach we had Ruge, R-U-G-A-E. They cannot really stretch like that. On top of those circular folds, you have to envision that gross anatomy picture I just showed you. On top of those circular folds are these finger-like projections of mucosa called villi. I think of them like little suction fingers inside the shop vac, and that's a great way, that's a great analogy that will help you later on. So suction fingers called villi are finger-like projections of mucosa that have in the core of the villus. There are blood capillaries shown here in red and blue. That's where most nutrients will get absorbed into. Then in green, an old friend of ours, a lymphatic capillary. If you remember that unit, fats are too big to get in our blood capillaries. We had to have a special lymphatic capillary to suck in the triglycerides. And they have a special name called lacteals. L-A-C-T-E-A-L-S. Lact for milk, because if you look inside there, it looks milky white. That's because they have the big fats like mayonnaise inside of them. So the villi are the suction fingers inside the shop vac. And just for fun, you don't have to memorize this, there are about 20 of these suction fingers on something the size of a pin head. Amazing to think about. Then, on top of the villi, on certain cells that line the villi, we have things called microvilli. These are tiny projections on the absorptive epithelial cells that line the villi. Here's one of those cells sucked out, showing you the microvilli. Someone looked at that under the microscope and said, oh, that looks like bristles on a brush. I think I'll call it something. And they called that the brush border with a star. This is fascinating to me, and you don't have to know this number either. But there are 200 million microvilli on something the size of a pinhead. Do you see now how we made a lot of surface area? We got circular folds with a whole bunch of villi on top of them, with a whole bunch of microvilli on top of them. And if you could like stretch out and unwind that puppy, that is massive surface area for massive digestion and absorption. This slide is absolutely sick. It's a transmission electron micrograph, 50,000 power, showing you microvilli. You got to remember there's 200 million of these on the size of a pinhead, so this is an amazing picture. And you can see now why it got its name, the brush border. Now we get to the meat of it, some serious physiology, just like in the stomach. You can't understand how the small intestine works unless you understand the specialized epithelial cells that line the mucosa. So there are four cell types with four names and four functions. It's not that bad, guys. Let's break it down. On the top, with a star on it, is this pink cell with the microvilli on the top as well. This is the cell that does the majority of the absorption. So what did some genius call that cell? They called it the absorptive cell. But please don't miss it on the test. Not only does the absorptive cell obviously absorb, it can do a little bit of digestion as well. So it digests and absorbs. I want to hit a little bit more detail here. The absorptive cell does have the metabolic machinery to produce a series of enzymes. It takes those enzymes, it plunks them up into the brush border, into those microvilli, and as food swims by the brush border, those digestive enzymes can help kind of finish off the digestive process. Those enzymes as a group, I want you to know, are called brush border enzymes. It ain't rocket science. But I want you to also know that those brush border enzymes can only digest two of our three major food groups. They can only help digest carbohydrates and proteins, but not lipids. How do I remember that? Well, I look at this cell. I remember it has the microvilli on top, and micro kind of sounds really small to me. So I just think in my head, this cell is too small to help digest fats. And that's just the way I do it. Second cell here on the diagram is the goblet cell. That should be an old friend of yours. Goblet cells make mucus. What is mucus for in the human body? One more time, to lubricate and protect. This leads us to this cell in blue. This is one of the key cells. This is called the enteroendocrine cell. It's the gut hormone cell that, of course, secretes hormones. This is where the all-powerful, all-controlling hormones called secretin and cholecystokinin come from. You must know that. They are powerful. Last but not least, shown here in yellow, I guess I'll make this my favorite cell now. It's called the Paneth cell. Notice what it can secrete. Our old friend lysozyme, that's the enzyme that could break apart bacteria. Furthermore, the Paneth cell has the ability to perform phagocytosis. So how do I remember this? The Paneth cell is the Pac-Man cell. It can squirt juice on bacteria, which breaks them apart. Then it can gobble them up. So very easily, the Paneth cell is the Pac-Man cell. Some of you are looking at that saying, okay, I can memorize that stuff, but it's not important. And here's a slide to give an example. You've heard of a condition called lactose intolerance. Many people are maybe born without the ability or develop the ability to digest lactose, which is milk sugar. And what happens here is the absorptive epithelial cells of the small intestine fail to produce one of their enzymes for carbs called lactase. So if you can't digest lactose, which is milk sugar, the bacteria inside your guts says, oh, I'm going to have a field day with this. Maybe you can't digest it because you got a problem, but I can sure do it, and I'll ferment that lactose, and I'll produce gases and other goodies, which leads to diarrhea and bloating and gas and flatulence and cramps, and anyone who has lactose intolerance knows this. So yes, this is important, even though it seems kind of trivial. So what do people do who are lactose intolerant? Let me pretend that I am, and I love ice cream, and I want to go out and have an ice cream sundae from Dairy Queen with 12 scoops of ice cream. What do I have to do to be able to maybe handle that? You can go to your local store and go to the pharmacy area, and you'll see there's something called Lactaid. And if you read the box on Lactaid, all those tablets contain is lactase, which is the enzyme to help digest our milk sugar. So supposedly the way it works is you pop one of those lactate pills and then, you know, wait a little bit and then you can go out and have your milk or ice cream or whatever. And, you know, I guess it works okay. You really can't probably go out and have 12 scoops of ice cream. It doesn't work that good. But you get the idea. Let's move out of the all-important mucosa into our next layer, which you know is the submucosa. The submucosa here does have two special goodies that you gotta know. We have some special glands that some people call duodenal glands, but in the lab we gave you another name. We called them Brunner's glands, didn't we? B-R-U-N-N-E-R apostrophe S. And look at the special juice they make. They make an alkaline mucus. Underline it. What is mucus for? It's to lubricate and protect. We've done it 1,000 times. What is alkaline for? I mean, if you mix alkaline with acid, you neutralize, don't you? I'll talk more in the next slide about the critical importance of that. The second thing you know that's key in the submucosa of the small intestine is there is lymphatic tissue. This is part of our malt to protect us from infection. Let's break it down, though, one at a time. Here comes a beautiful long section of the duodenum, and in the submucosa of the duodenum, look at these little round glandular structures clustered together. Those are called duodenal or Brunner's glands. they squirt out an alkaline mucus. Here's why. Check this out. You know, of course, you can't live without your heart. You know, of course, you can't live without your brain. But I bet you didn't know that you can't live without your Bruner's glands. Because here's the deal. If you shoot the acid soup right from your stomach into the duodenum without doing anything about it, you're going to burn all these fingers. All these villi are going to be like French fries. And you're going to burn all the enzymes. Well, they're not going to work. Enzymes in your intestines do not work in an acid environment. So, immediately upon sensing the acid, the Bruner's glands squirt out their alkaline mucus. Mucus to lubricate and protect, and alkaline to neutralize the acid. Therefore, all our beautiful digestive enzymes coming up can work. So, we wouldn't live but a couple weeks, maybe tops, without our Bruner's glands. Here's a nice picture of patches of lymphatic nodules in the submucosa of the ileum. Remember from another part of the course or from lab, patches of lymphatic nodules in the ileum have a special name. Write it down again. They're called Peyer's patches. P-E-Y-E-R apostrophe S. That's why everyone who eats an E. coli cheeseburger doesn't necessarily get sick and die, because maybe our Peyer's patches with all those lymphocytes will kick into gear and protect us. The other two layers, I really don't have anything to say. Yeah, there's a muscularis. Yeah, there's a serosa in the small intestine. But check it out, simply what it's saying. In the muscularis, two layers of smooth muscles. Duh, same old, same old. Mechanical digestion? Yeah, of course, because we've got muscle and we do peristalsis. Serosa here, the shiny covering, you know it's called the visceral peritoneum. So on this slide, there's nothing new I could ask you guys. I would write somewhere off in the margin, same old, same old. You really can't ask me anything special or new here. So let's move on and finish with this slide. The mesentery. The mesentery is a special fold of peritoneum that binds the small intestine to the posterior abdominal wall. If you saw it in a cat lab, if you tug on the small intestine, you couldn't really rip it out. Don't try to now. You couldn't rip it out because the mesentery anchored the small intestine to the back body cavity wall. I hope you looked at it carefully. It looks like a fan with a whole bunch of beautiful colored vessels in it, doesn't it? Besides vessels with a star, there's also lymph nodes in the mesentery. Let's talk about lymph nodes first, because you know already they're there to help fight infection. Then we'll talk about vessels. What are these vessels for? Look at this figure to your right showing the vessels going back and forth to this shot vac we call the small intestine. Vessels, of course, are going to do the age-old thing, with, you know, in with the good, out with the bad. Of course, this organ, like other organs, we have to deliver oxygen and so forth to the organ to keep it alive. We have to take away any waste products as well. But here's the big picture, because this is the digestive part of the course, and this is where 90% of the action's happening in the shot vac. In these vessels, also, we have the blood and lymph vessels that are absorbing all the nutrients into our system and delivering them to our body. We'll see specifically they're going to deliver those nutrients to the liver, either directly or indirectly. So those vessels deliver the nutrients to the liver. Very important. You'll see problems, by the way, with these vessels. Just like you can have a stroke to your brain or a stroke to your heart, which is really called a heart attack, you can have blockages of these arteries to the small intestine. People, again, with high cholesterol, high blood pressure, diabetes, smokers, you can have a stroke to the small bowel, and it's called a small bowel infarction, and you will see them. I asked a surgeon here in Bay County how many cases he saw in his practice. He said he saw 5 cases of small bowel infarction a week. That's huge. And what happens is, if you cut off the blood supply, you kill it. It becomes dead, gangrenous. At surgery, it turns like a black-brown color. It's dying. It smells horrible. You'll never forget the smell if you're in on one of those cases. You rush them to the OR. You cut out the dead bowel. You sew together the good ends. And that's the easy part. I mean, no disrespect to the surgeon. I'm just saying. The hard part is what you're going to do. Because the hard part is keeping them alive the next couple weeks in the surgical intensive care unit, because they're prone to, of course, you can imagine infection, maybe a lot of bacteria already leaked out into their peritoneal cavity, and it's just a battle to keep them alive. If you're ever in on the surgery on one of those cases of dead bowel, you'll never forget it, because as you can imagine, it smells horrific. Then you also might see little kitties come to the ER with an emergency, sick as a dog. They come in and you rush them up to the OR and you might find they have a condition called volvulus. I love the word volvulus because it sounds like something's revolving. When we're developing, there's a normal kind of rotation where all our guts sort of eventually neatly kind of plunk into their proper positions. But that doesn't always go properly, and sometimes the small intestine will twist in little babies on the mesentery. And if I twist the mesentery, you can imagine I'm going to kink shut all those blood vessels. And again, they come in sick as a dog, and you brush them up to the OR. We used to open up their bellies, find their intestines, and we would untwist them and put them back in. Unfortunately, it tends to recur. And if you Google it, you'll find some fascinating images of this come up. So once again, we see this is real life stuff. It is important. And yes, you got to know it. And yes, you will see it again in the future.